Hi, this is Patrick Keeney, the CEO of Subeca, and you're listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations: by Black & Veatch, building a world of difference; by 120 Water, new rules need new tools; by Suez Digital Solutions, optimizing water; by IDE Water Technologies, your partner in water treatment and sustainable desalination for six decades; by Advanced Drainage Systems, our reason is water; by 1898 & Co., possibilities powered by experience; by Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operations services; by Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow; by Xylem, let's solve water; and by the American Water Works Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource. This is Session 276.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGimsey.
Well, hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey, and thank you for joining me, and thank you for your support over the last 11 plus years now. We've got a great show for you this month. Shimon Constante returns to the guest chair to discuss disinfection and water reuse in Latin American markets. And Shimon always does a great interview, so stay tuned. It's a great interview that Shimon delivers again. Also, Reese Tisdale joins us for a Bluefield on Tap segment that provides insights gleaned from Bluefield's recent report on the investor-owned utility market. But before we get to today's conversations, we always say thank you to our awesome sponsors at the top of every show, and we have fantastic sponsors this year. We have Black & Veatch, 120 Water, Suez Digital Solutions, IDE Water Technologies, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, and the American Water Works Association. And that, my friends, is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education. And I thank you all. And I'd like for you to do me a favor. If you work for or with any of those sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and let them know that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through that sponsorship. You'd be very surprised how far a simple little note of thanks will go. And as long as you're letting sponsors know that you appreciate their support of water industry education and thought leadership, hey, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It would be greatly appreciated and, of course, helps others find out about the podcast. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Yes, that's kind of important. Well, we're ready to go, but before we head on to the interview with Shimon, we've got a Bluefield on Tap segment with Bluefield Research's Reese Tisdale. So take it away, guys. Well, Reese, welcome to another Bluefield on Tap. How are you doing this month?
I'm pretty good, pretty good. And you've been on my mind. That's because the Seattle Mariners are in first place, as we talk about.
Let's not jinx it.
The other is, we've never even talked about basketball, but I find it hard to believe that I'm rooting for the Indiana Pacers win at all. That's what I'm rooting for.
Yeah, well, so if the Pacers do make the NBA Finals, that would have my, because I was a Sonics fan for a long time, and the Oklahoma City is the team that kind of replaced the Sonics. So I'm not going to say they moved, because the Sonics will always be in Seattle, but it'll be the two teams that I have the most connection to facing off in the finals. Go Pacers.
Yeah, I'm all about the Pacers. I'm a big Aaron Nesmith went to the school where I grew up. So
that's
I'm
all right.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about the Pacers. It was the Boston Celtic too, for what it's worth.
Very good. Well, a lot going on in the water sector as always. So what has risen to the top of Bluefield's stack this month?
Well, this time I thought it might be of interest to you. It's sort of closer to your world in some respects. And that is, we've just done analysis of the leading IUs, top 20 IUs in water, wastewater in the U.S. So these investor-owned utilities are the movers and shakers of what other people may call private participation in water. And so we've done that, and I thought I'd share some of my insights.
Yeah, well, let's hear it. First, can you kind of like, because it seems to me that there are a couple of mammoth players and then there are a lot of smaller players. Is that kind of how you see the market shaking out? I mean, who's kind of making up the top
companies? Yeah, it's no doubt. It feels like you're reading my notes. I'd say, you know, so big picture. So these top 20 IOUs, they serve about 9 million connections in the U.S. So think water and wastewater, when you account for the differences, it's about 5% of total connections are served by these investor and utility. So it's really not that big. But as far as like the big players, right? So there is one, if you want to call it 800-pound gorilla, that would be American Water. They serve about, as far as market share goes, they're about 39% of the total. So they're huge, followed by the next three. So that would be Essential, Veolia, and Cal Water. And their market share ranges anywhere from 6 to 12%, respectively.
Yeah, that's interesting. I thought the total market share would be greater, because I've always assumed around 15% of the market would be served by private, and I heard 5. So kind of.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're getting at. So the EPA puts out its list, and particularly when you look at drinking water systems or utilities. And when you categorize it or filter it by private, it's about 14 to 15%, pretty close to that. And so that's the number that most people use. But what we've done at Bluefield is we've said, okay, well, wait a second. These are private, sure, but which ones of these actually are what we would call companies that have a strategy? They're multi-jurisdictional. And so, you know, when you weed out the top 20 investor in utilities, that number goes down to 5%. The other, say 9% is trailer parks, small communities, and they're categorized as private. So if anything, they're oftentimes targets for acquisition more than anything else. So I think that's really the difference in what we're looking at.
Got it. So, when you were doing this research, apart from kind of the strata of the various companies that are in the private sector, what other interesting tidbits did your research turn up?
Well, one of the things is, so when we started looking at this originally, we were looking at M&A, and so who's growing and how they're doing it. So 59% of the deals over the past 5 years among these companies are really in 6 states. So we're looking at Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Arizona, and Pennsylvania. That's really where the action is. Texas has leapt forward. That is the most competitive state. So that's one aspect of it. I think also, and we may have talked about this, I don't recall, but I think the past 5 or 6 year average is about 135 deals a year. That's acquisitions year. That number's fallen. Actually, this past year, 2024, fell to about 100. So there's a 35 deal drop, which is a little, that was one of the bigger swings we've seen over the past decade.
That's interesting. Now, so I've been thinking a lot about this topic lately. Really, since I saw that at least in the House passed version of the One Big Beautiful Bill, there's going to be a significant cut to SRF funding, and in my view, that will cause municipal systems to, if that makes it into the final bill, and SRF funding is cut, that will almost certainly require municipal water utilities to, you know, have the full cost of water, which may make it easier for IOUs to come in and serve, because the advantage that municipals have always had is the lower debt financing to undertake projects. That might go away if the SRF goes. I mean, do you have a take on that?
Yeah, it is actually. I had a discussion about this morning with someone, and we're talking about the risk to SRF funding. Generally, it's been bipartisan. Like, everybody congressionally has felt pretty good about it. Given what's happening in the administration, Congress has been pretty silent. So as they work through these details, there are a couple points of concern when it comes to SRF funding. One is that the earmarks, the congressional earmarks are starting to cut into that. They're sort of, the earmarks are back in play, which were disallowed until recently. So that's a risk to them. And the other part of that is, you know, they are going to be looking for, you know, are they conflating WIFIA with state revolving funds, right? So there's all this horse trading taking place in Congress for the big, beautiful bill. What does that mean? I mean, there are, you know, hundreds, thousands of systems that do rely on these low interest loans. And so it is a real concern. You know, I was pointedly, someone said, what's going to happen? Can you give me a number on whether you think it's going to, they're going to disappear or not? I can't. I've stopped, you know, watching the sausage being made in Washington. But I think it's a legitimate concern, at least for those utilities. And so the money is going to have to come from somewhere. So oftentimes the smaller systems get access to those funds. That's a big part of what they are there for. And it does vary wildly by state. Some states are much further ahead than others, and some utilize them at greater levels. And so, yeah, if there's a vacuum, then the IOUs certainly will try to step in at least.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think. Well, you identified it. You hit the nail on the head when you said the smaller systems are the ones that most often take advantage of that funding. Well, they're the ones that will get vacuumed up by the IOUs.
And they're already the ones that are traditionally being acquired. I think 60 to 70% of deals or acquisitions that take place, and their consolidation, regionalization, whatever you want to call it, needs to happen. There's so many systems, so many small systems. And, you know, but 60 to 70% of deals that take place even today by IOUs are for smaller, very small systems.
Well, Reese, as always, great information. We could talk for hours on this, but I really appreciate the insights, really appreciate your knowledge, and thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again in July.
All right, Dave, look forward to it, and it'll be a good summer. Go Pacers.
As always, great information from Bluefield Research and Reese Tisdale. Now it's time for the main event, our interview with Shimon Constante. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Shimon, welcome back to the Water Values Podcast. Great to have you back on. How have you been lately?
Great, David. First of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak again. It has been a while since we last spoke. Things have been great. I think the water market is going through some very interesting period. Continuing what I've been doing always, in consulting and in my previous experience with MIA, I'm currently focusing on water disinfection, as a EVP strategic growth at Atlantium. Dealing mainly with that area of water where you are, where we're focused on both, potable water and wastewater disinfection, which I'm sure we're going to have a lot of opportunity to speak today.
Absolutely. So very interested. I always find Latin America a fascinating region. I just think it's really interesting. And one of the things that you kind of brought up when we were talking initially was Mexico and how the new administration down there has put kind of water at front and center, which when we started that conversation, it was before the Rio Grande issues popped up between the U.S. and Mexico. So can you just fill us in, like, big picture, what's going on with water in Mexico?
Sure. I think one of the things that we're seeing in Mexico, which is very similar to what we're seeing in many countries around the world, and specifically speaking in Latin America, is we're seeing a water crisis is basically becoming a very big issue. Not only that has been a big issue for a while, but it has recently been also one of the 5 points of the governmental campaign, which the new Sheinbaum president has been announcing is something to deal with. Mexico is dealing with this regardless of the conflict, the current conflict, I would say, with Rio Grande. In the U.S., Mexico, I think, is dealing with a few main fronts, and I would name a few. One is the scarcity, which the scarcity is becoming an issue not only in the outskirts of, you know, cities like Mexico City, rather in the centers of big cities like Mexico City, Monterrey, Guadalajara, and those are big production centers. The other thing is the pollution itself. Pollution, wastewater pollution has become a big issue, even if you're not looking at the reuse aspect of it yet, or reclamation of water. The wastewater and its impact on the environment has become real. And I love seeing that from my perspective, at least, and the attention that is being given to that. And maybe the last point, which has to do with both scarcity and pollution, is this interaction basically that Mexico has along its border with the U.S. And, you know, who assumes which responsibility, who's taking care of, you know, preventing pollution. And there we're seeing a big crisis, which is obviously with the new administration on both sides, is coming up and becoming a real issue where both sides will need to resolve in one way or another. And we're seeing a lot of investment coming into that specifically.
That's really interesting. You brought up the pollution. Now, so if I can put this in perspective, the U.S. had lax environmental rules until Silent Spring was published and the U.S. EPA was established in the early 70s. Is Mexico heading that direction where they have a stronger environmental regulatory scheme?
Yes, yes. So, you know, the norms that have been under regulation so far in Mexico have typically, some of them have been in place, as we see in the U.S., and we have a few examples in the U.S. where different states act differently. But on a federal level in Mexico, some norms have been in place, but have not been rigid enough, I would say. So regardless of whether you're allowing to reuse your water, either direct or indirect, for potable reuse or for agriculture, the regulation on what is the measurement of disinfection, what are the levels that are allowed, have not been well established yet. And one of the things that have been on the agenda of this new government is to really define those. So we have a norm, for example, norm 001 of CERMANT in Mexico, which is basically defining now, it's being updated with the tightening their monitoring, which I think is one of the most essential things when we talk about reuse and regulation by itself. And the other thing is, besides the monitoring aspect, is what criteria do I give the different organizations in order to be able to reuse. So we have new norms 001, we have 003 that is also defining how treated wastewater can be reused, whether, you know, human contact or not. But, you know, David, I think it's important also to say that when we look at the U.S., the U.S. is very, you know, very scattered in the sense of certain states that have guidelines. Not always it's a regulation, but sometimes it's a guidelines for industrial applications, for example, versus other applications like agriculture in the reuse, when we look at reuse. So Florida, for example, is a good example of, you know, having very straight guidelines on all levels of reuse. But you see other states like Minnesota, which would have very clear guidelines for non-potable water reuse, but will not have really clear guidelines about industrial applications reuse. So Mexico is going to the same thing in the federal level, but it's, I would say, doing some headway in providing clearer guidelines I think what we have to be watching for is to see how well will this be monitored and what are going to be the incentives as well, whether it's industrially reused. So what are going to be the incentives for the industries themselves? And that's something that, you know, I'm looking very closely at the moment with the big industries, big companies like Toyota, car manufacturers, semiconductors, microelectronics that are there, data centers and so forth. So it's something to be watched yet.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Now, what's playing out in Mexico, is that consistent with the rest of Latin America?
I would say, in a sense, yes. In a sense, yes. I think if we look at, I would say, three countries that are the most prominent in that sense, I would look at Mexico, Chile, and Brazil, which are doing some very good headways. I think some of them have an intrinsic, I would say, dilemma, or I would say some kind of misalignment between their basic rules, human rights rules, and the use of water rules that are not enabling the reuse enough. So Chile has some contradiction between, you know, whether you are able to take water and not throw it to the river and do reuse for industrial usage, for example. So there are some conflicts between agriculture farms and those industries, or in specifically speaking, for example, mining companies that are using very high levels of water. Brazil is going through the same thing. Still, it's not well regulated whether you can take the water, wastewater, reuse it for agriculture. So those three countries, I would say, are setting the trends for Latin America. While on the other hand, you have many countries like Peru, Colombia, and others, which are a little bit behind in that sense. We are seeing, though, trends of improving the legal framework. But if you ask me, the most important thing would be in the end of the day, and I think this goes across many countries, but specifically speaking in Latin America, it would be important to have the industries incentivized and on the other hand penalized. But how do we create a situation where the industries, which are the highest water consumers, will have the interest to reuse, or will have the tight regulations to force them to at least treat the wastewater or effluent to the level where it could be easily reused by the social and environmental beneficiaries.
Right. So talk to me a little about reuse. I mean, you mentioned disinfection early on in this conversation, and that's a key aspect of reuse. So can you talk a little about the role disinfection plays in reuse?
Sure. So this, you know, all along, I think we've been accustomed to looking at filtration and how, I would say, maybe the primary and secondary types of treatment, where you mainly would take, I would say, bigger particles out, and mainly those industries which need very highly disinfected water would be focused on high technologies such as Atlantiums to disinfect the water to the highest degree. So if we look, for example, at the semiconductors industry, you look at the ultra pure water that is being used there, they've been able to invest a lot of money to make sure that the water is extremely highly disinfected. Pharmaceutical, we look at companies like Coca-Cola, for example, or Pepsi. Companies have been investing a lot in their processes. Nevertheless, when you look at so far at what has been going on with wastewater, wastewater has typically been going through some very low level disinfection to a degree that it would be discharged into some environmental, whether it's a, you know, the sea, whether it's a river, And there would not be such a high concern with this infection. This is one end. The other hand, which I think it's a little bit more more dangerous, is what we're seeing with the PFAS at the moment. So we're seeing very high level pollutants being discharged by the industry and creating very high contaminations. So when we are looking at disinfection, going back to your question, we're trying to find out which technology or which process, and sometimes it's a few technologies combined together, can bring to the highest disinfection level where the cost benefit makes sense, or where you have a good positive ROI. So that's one thing that is happening in the background when we look at disinfection. But the other thing, and this is a little bit looking at, you know, how do I minimize the environmental impact in general? Disinfection so far has been done by chemicals. So there is a big understanding that we have to reduce or at least be more efficient in the way we use chemicals. And when we, on one hand, want to disinfect by using chemicals, but on the other hand, are trying not to impact the environment with, for example, chlorine into water resources, we're looking, okay, so which technology can make it more sustainable? Which technology is better, higher impact, and cost effective? Sometimes we will find ourselves drawn towards the cheapest solution, as we always know, and this is the big challenge, especially when we're looking at you know, municipal water utilities and so forth, is how do we not necessarily go to the cheapest, but go to the most sustainable? And this is where I think regulation needs to be taking a very strong role and define those limits. You know, what is, okay, you want to reach disinfection, but how much do I allow you to use chemicals? What we're seeing today in the disinfection world, which is interesting, there is, apart from the, you know, outside regulation or governmental kind of regulations, EPA and so forth, you are seeing self-regulated companies, companies like Google and others, who are imposing self-regulation on their environmental responsibility, on how much they're using chemicals and what are the alternatives there. I think the challenge, the real challenge with disinfection is how do you, on one hand, really destroy those dangerous components like PFAS or the forever chemicals that we call, as we call them? How do you destroy them in an effective manner on one hand? On the other hand, is how do we make sure that we disinfect to the exact level where it's beneficial for the environment and cost effective for whoever is doing that, whether it's an industry, whether it's a government and so forth. And we've seen a lot of development in disinfection in general, in various technologies. I think there is a very interesting combination of technologies recently, especially when we're looking at, for example, advanced oxidation solutions, where you combine different processes, different technologies that aim to really disinfect to the highest degree in the most complicated effluents.
Yeah, so that's a really fascinating way to look at things, with the self-regulation versus government-imposed regulation. You know, I look at that as a bell curve. If everyone was just allowed to self-regulate, yeah, you're going to have some companies who do a great job of self-regulation, and they're going to be at the right end, so to speak, of that bell curve. But most companies are going to be in the middle, and then there'll be some environmental laggards, so to speak, right at the other end of the bell curve. And so what are you seeing in terms of the disinfection? I mean, is Latin America, are the countries there moving towards a more robust regulatory scheme that will force the methods for disinfection and spur technological advancement once there are clear rules in place? Or is this kind of just we're relying on companies to self-regulate? What's your perspective on that in LATAM?
Yeah, so I think we're seeing two main dynamics, I would say. The first one is those multinational companies such as I mentioned before, Coca-Cola or Kimberly-Clark and so forth, which are internationally managed and their vision is international. Nevertheless, they have local big industries. So just one example, Kimberly-Clark in Mexico has many plants that are very, very big. Some of them are the main distributor of certain products, for example, such as the wet towels for babies. Even they are being actually exported to the U.S. So we're seeing those big companies who have decided to self-regulate themselves, and they take the highest measures and the highest standards for disinfection. And that is interesting because in some cases, I would say, it's so rigid that the disinfection levels are higher than what it's needed, but the regulation has been set anonymously for all the world. So that's one thing that you're seeing in Latin America happening very interestingly, both in Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, Chile, those multinational companies that have operations worldwide. On the other hand, what is you're seeing is governments, or maybe I would say not necessarily governments, but government entities, building certain incentives to allow for that disinfection or that regulation to be taken place and to be financially justifiable. So, for example, if we look at Brazil as an example, Sao Paulo. So Sao Paulo actually created a joint venture between Sabespe and now its partner GS Inema. They have built a wastewater treatment plant called Aquapolo, which is actually selling their water to Braskane, the treated water. That by itself was initiated by Sabespe, which was until recently a governmental owned entity, water utility. It's now been, it has been fully privatized. And they were the ones who have actually initiated this in order to create a water reuse or wastewater reuse treatment plan that made sense financially. And that's something you're starting to see in various places. We're seeing this, for example, mentioned in Mexico, Monterrey has done an amazing work with actually being approved by the health ministry to do direct potable reuse, something that is not even regulated by the government. But financially, it's justifiable, and they've been able to do that. So I think we're seeing two things. We're seeing on one hand, we're seeing the private international companies having a worldwide regulation. On the other hand, we're seeing entities, whether it's mainly pushed by governmental entities to do something that makes sense financially. What we're not seeing enough, I think, and it's starting in some cases, is regulated that are higher in penalizing. So I penalize you if you extract or you're trying to get more water rights than what I expect you to use. And if you remember, David, we spoke about this a few years ago when we were speaking about water scarcity and efficiency in non-revenue water and so forth. So we're seeing the same thing. So at the time we were talking about governments making sure you're not having high levels of non-revenue water and ensuring you're using the right amount of water you need to use and not losing it. And now if I look at the flip side of it, I'm looking at wastewater. How are you treating the water and reusing it? And how do I incentivize you? But I can also penalize you if you're using too much water and not recycling or not reusing or whatever the term will be. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. Now, let's look at disinfection again. I want to circle back on this real quick, because in the U.S. there's a lot of water utilities have moved to the UV disinfection as a result of regulation. Are you seeing similar things in Latin America on?
Yeah, so we're seeing two things, which is interesting, and it's good you mentioned that. Thank you. We're seeing two things in that respect that I can mention that I think might be interesting for our audience. The first thing we're seeing is that certain processes, production processes, and I'll mention two examples. Okay, so we can look at companies, the bottling companies, without mentioning specific names, that have been using chlorine in their processes, and then they're using activated carbon to take out the chlorine. And these processes have been established many, many years ago, and they've become standard. So some of these companies are now saying, well, activated carbon is not that safe. Some particles might go down into the process, into the water we're actually drinking. Chlorine for sure is cancer promoter. So that's one thing we're seeing, and we're seeing it's taking time. It's taking time. They're testing, and they're saying, okay, wait, if I can use UV instead of using chlorine, if I can take the carbon, the active carbon from my process and do recirculation and have UV granting, and I take you back, David, to the word, which I think is very important, monitoring, that I monitor actually the microbiological effect. If I can monitor that, but I can take all those dangerous elements in my production line, I will be safe with technologies like UV, and UV has been shown to be very, very sustainable. So that requires that me, as a bottling company, for example, to change my entire process and thought. And this is not only on a national level. Typically, those companies, big companies, are doing this internationally. And we're seeing that. So we've been testing with quite a few companies that have been afraid to change that. And this is great to see. This, by the way, this is something that I see in Latin America as a leader. So we're seeing Latin America really leading in that respect. I can't mention the names, unfortunately, but some of the big companies are doing really good headways with taking this forefront and saying, okay, we will change the processes, and we're taking the risk in changing process. Obviously, they're testing and proving this, and in some of this process changes take a year or 2 years, and we are very active in that respect because we really believe in the sustainability of UV, and that's one thing. The other thing that you're seeing, and this is more kind of the municipal sector, is you see certain countries, and not necessarily in Latin America yet, and this is where I think Latin America is lagging behind, approving the use of UV instead of chlorine, for example. So we're seeing the Netherlands have taken chloride out as a law, and you have to use UV. In some other cases, for example, in Israel, UV has been put in the regulation as a, I would say, a very good alternative for others. We're seeing some cases where UV is even being forced as mandatory in the process. So kind of to sum up a little bit, what we're seeing in the UV world is we're seeing, on one hand, UV being given as a good alternative. Some cases, chemicals are being completely taken out. And it's really interesting to see that happening. So I would say, just as a summary, industrial-wise, Latin America is doing great work with taking UV technology as a disinfection alternative. Municipal is still lagging a little bit behind. If you look at the municipal, by the way, just it might be worthwhile to mention, you do see UV being used in wastewater discharge. So you see open channel solutions like the ones Atlantium has to be used for discharge, but yet not the part of reuse. So that will happen after. So you disinfect with UV and then you throw into whatever resource, whether it's an aquifer or a river, but we're still not seeing the high disinfection with UV after that process. But that's happening slowly. I think we're going to see great headways in the next 2 years in Latin America specifically. And as I mentioned, we will see it very strongly in Mexico, Chile, and Brazil. And hopefully the other countries are going to be coming through. For example, EPM in Colombia is designing some very big projects now with the UV disinfection in wastewater. And there are other countries that are also a little bit more hesitant.
Well, Shimon, that sounds like a great wrap up. Thank you so much for coming on. It was great to reconnect. I always enjoy speaking with you. And you were absolutely fabulous today, by the way. For those who want to find out more about you and your work at Atlantium, where can they go to get that information?
Sure, David. First of all, likewise, great talking to you, like always. You guys, anybody can reach us at either www.atlantium.com and me personally at shimon.c@atlantium.com. Anywhere you can reach us with no problem.
Awesome. Well, Shimon, thanks again. Really appreciate your time, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you, David. Yep. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I always enjoy catching up with Shimon. He's got great insights into Latin American markets, and he's just an absolute pleasure to speak with. Thanks for coming back on the podcast, Shimon, and sharing your insights. Really appreciate it. Well, I'd love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast. Click the first link that comes up. That's our home on the web that Bluefield Research provides us. Longtime listeners know that Bluefield Research and the Water Values LLC are not affiliates. We just have a joint marketing arrangement. And as part of that, Bluefield Research gives us a home on the web. Well, you can email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at that landing page I mentioned earlier as well. Thank you again for tuning in. I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you to our sponsors. And sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include Black & Veatch, 120 Water, Suez Digital Solutions, IDE Water Technologies, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, and the American Water Works Association. This show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And thank you for listening and for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
You've been listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues because no one knows everything about water.